One of the all-time greats, Robert Scheidt, is joining us this evening. And we're going to be asking him tons of questions, including how to start. Hi, my name's Andy Rice, and I can't tell you how excited Hamish and I are to have Robert along for this call. Hamish, you're great friends with another great Brazilian, Torben Grau. When did Robert first come to your attention?
I think Robert's been always in my attention. I mean, just an amazing sailor, and it's such a privilege to have you along, Robert. And we first crossed paths at a Brazilian barbecue, if I remember, and outside a container somewhere.
What?
Such a humble, such an amazing guy. And yeah, I was eating up your words, mate.
Well, Robert, thanks for joining us. And really good to have you along. So where are you today?
Thanks, Andy. Thanks for inviting me. Hi, Hamish. Good to be with you guys. I'm here at home, Lake Garda, Italy. Having a great time with the family. Congratulations for the very nice tool that you have developed. I think it is a very complex sport, and it is very nice to share information. And I think especially for emerging nations that don't have so much access to information, I think it's a great opportunity to learn from a lot of people. So it is it's a wide sport, so there's many classes, there's many ways of doing this sport, and I think it's a great tool to have so we can share experiences. So thanks everybody who joined, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Robert, that's so kind of you. Thank you very much. And you've gone right to the heart of one of the big reasons why Hamish and I wanted to put Road to Gold together, which was to share high level information, the kind of campaign knowledge that Hamish has amassed over the last 40 years. So tell me, when you were getting started, probably getting on for 30 years ago in Brazil, how did you get started? Where did you go to get your knowledge and understand what you needed to do to put together a world-beating campaign?
Yeah, well, I started sailing with my dad very early at 6 years old. I was becoming his crew. And then at 9 years old, I was giving my first Optimist, made by wood at those times, built by my uncle. I did a few years of Optimist sailing, did one time the Opti Worlds, did not so well, but managed to qualify, which is already a pretty hard thing to do. But Optimist was nice, was fun. I learned how to race. And then from then on, I sailed Snipes for a few years, which was nice because it's a double-hander boat, has some tuning on it. So I learned to sail with a crew. I learned to sail with two sails. And then I was getting bigger. And then the Laser was the hot class in Brazil at that time. It was big fleets. Everybody was doing laser sailing. And then it was natural for me to start doing that. At that time, there was no 4.7, no radio. So I went straight into the standard with like 68 kilos. So it was pretty tough at the beginning. But I was really motivated to sail against great guys like Peter Tanchard, who was like a mentor to me. He was the world champion of those years, and I grew up idolizing him. So it was great to have those experiences with a lot of good guys. Lars and Torben were already winning medals at the game, so that inspired me a lot to keep improving and to dreaming to one day participating at the games. So that was my pathway. I also did some other sports, not only sailing. I grew up, my family was always very sportive. My father also introduced me to many sports. And I played tennis quite competitively until I was 16 years old. So that was also a very nice experience because tennis is a very demanding physically. There's a lot of agility involved. It's a very mental game. So I think those years playing tennis, I think helped me a lot on making me, you know, a better overall athlete and being more ready to compete later on. But yeah, everything started naturally. There was no pressure and there was not really a big expectation to become an Olympic medalist one day. So everything happened step by step. And then, yeah, in 1993, the laser became Olympic. And then I really started to, you know, to dream that I could be there, you know. So then I worked really hard. Peter was the guy to beat. We had a tough trials. It was one or the other, one regatta, and I managed to get the spot and go to the Olympics, and I had that big fight against Ben. I ended up winning the gold. So it was, I could keep talking here, but I think we have to go into the real subject.
That was all a super interesting introduction for us, Robert. The laser becoming Olympic came along at just the right time for you. And I just wonder if the laser hadn't have become an Olympic class, would you have still pursued a sailing career in the laser, or would you have found something else to do in the Olympic arena?
Yes, well, it's a good question, because I think my physical abilities, my weight, my size, and my style of sailing at those years, the laser was the perfect class. So I don't know if I could have sailed other classes at that point in my career. Later on, I did two campaigns in the Star, but it was later when I was over 30 years old. So I was more technically developed, let's say, to sail a boat like the Star. But I think I was, like you said, at the right place at the right time. The laser becoming Olympic, I was 22 years old. So it was, everything really fell into place. And like I said, it was great to have a very strong competition inside Brazil, because I think that helps a lot. You know, we are far away from Europe, so if you can sail at a high level in your own country, not having to travel overseas all the time, that helps a lot.
Our main topic this evening is asking about starting, and thanks to Rod and Alex already dropping great questions into the chat box. That's what it's there for. If you, Rod and Alex, can just indicate whether you're able to come in and ask your questions directly to Robert, that's what we really prefer to do. So just indicate to me if you're able to do so, because it really lights up the conversation when we get audience participation. So we look forward to that. And we don't normally get questions this early on. People tend to be shy early on, and then we have far too many questions at the end. So thank you also to Jason dropping in your questions. So we're going to get on to those in a moment. But Robert, one thing that always stood out about the Brazilian sailors, I don't know if it's still true today, downwind speed. Torben Grail, really fast downwind. Peter Tanscheit, really fast downwind. You were really fast downwind. What do you put that down to?
Yeah, well, I think it's in Brazil, usually our training is a little bit different. You know, we used to do like a lot of long downwinds, and we had great conditions to sail downwind. And we, like Europeans, they train more the small courses, a lot of starts, a lot of racing situations, which is also really good. And perhaps that's what we lack a little bit in Brazil. But because we're sailing always on great conditions, 12 months per year with sun and wind, and a lot of times also by ourselves, we kind of develop a lot of the feeling with the boat. And I think the feeling of what makes the boat go fast, how you position your body, when to pump and how to surf a wave, and just getting that constant feedback from the boat. And I think those hours, like repeating those long upwinds and downwinds, because to go downwind, you have to go upwind as well, unfortunately. But we developed that really good technique, and I think it was a great surprise when we were coming to Europe to see that we could pass a lot of boats on the reaches and the downwind, especially in the downwind, because like Peter was one of the first ones who started to, in the laser, to do a lot more transitions going downwind and trying to extend the surfs for a long time and trying to not let the boat stop and to not move the rudder too much. So I think Torben was also, you know, one of the greats downwind, and he obviously sailed a lot outside Guanabara Bay, also doing long downwinds. So that those kind of trainings, I think you become very, very connected to your boat, and you really kind of understand what makes the boat go and what to do when. So I think that's kind of an explanation why Brazilians do so well downwind.
But you do have to go upwind, as you just said. So did you ever have a coach or a friend to tow you back upwind again?
No, not really. Sometimes we had to do it the hard way. Sometimes we had an ebbing current, which helped a lot too. So you can sail quickly upwind and then you have the long downwind. But a lot of the times we're just going upwind for an hour and then coming back down and doing it again. So it was good to develop the legs and then the downwind. But I think also we had great races in Brazil. We had a lot of races on the weekends, and there was a chance to also compare with the others and see other guys' techniques, and that helped all the fleet get stronger and stronger.
Great. Hamish, I see some parallels in the in what the Brazilians were doing with what you were doing in New Zealand, making the best of a situation where you were had limited access to large regattas. And so you concentrate and focus on the things that you're able to focus on. And it seems like that was one of the reasons why the Brazilians have done as well as they have.
Yeah, I think there's a real close synergy between Brazil, and what Rob's saying is exactly what happened here too. I'd be curious to know sort of what hours, Rob. I mean, I think there's big hours here, eh? In those early days.
Yeah, in my early days, it was big hours. It was you know, we were never getting tired, so we could do it for a long time. But we also enjoyed. We kept it fun, you know. We try to create some exercises. We try to let the slow guy go in front, try to catch him, or we try to change boats. We try to do like tight reaches, broad reaches, and, you know, jibing exercises just to keep it fun. But I think the long hours develop that feel you have for the boat and that connection you have to the boat and understanding how you're going to take the best out of the boat and how your body interacts with the sail and everything that helps a lot. So you can focus when you're sailing. You can not think about making the boat go fast. The boat goes fast without you forcing something, which is also very important, because usually downwind you go very fast when you're not trying to overdo something, or when you're not trying to force a situation, when things flow and when you're really making the turns or the pumps or the body movements in the right direction. And it takes time to develop this, but it's like in any other sport, I think the repetition makes you not have to think about it. No?
I'm just going to leave. We're going to leave Facebook Live. We're going to stay on this live Zoom call. If you're watching on Facebook Live, I hope you've managed to see the link somewhere and you can join us for the rest of the call. So goodbye to you on Facebook. But Robert, I remember asking the late great Bart Simpson, who you used to race against with Ian Percy on the GBR Star, and there was a point where you were doing some training with Ian and Bart, and I asked what is the secret to Robert Scheidt, what makes him so good, and it was a very, very fast answer. There was no doubt in Bart Simpson's mind what the answer was, and it's that Robert works harder than anybody else. It's not a talent thing, it's just that his work ethic is higher than even Ian Percy's and Bart's themselves, and they had to raise their game to match your work effort. So I don't know if you ever heard that, but that's what I heard from Bart. And is that something you've always understood that you had to do from day one of your campaign?
Yeah, well, I think those guys, they said that, but they work really hard too, you know, and especially on the last cycle to London, I think they were the guys who worked most in Weymouth, and they were really ready, and they were really prepared to win the gold medal, which they almost did in London. Had a great time racing those guys. Ian and Bart was a great atmosphere between us. A few tough final races of regattas, but in the end we can all laugh about it and think about those great races we had together. But yeah, I mean, I think it all comes from the love you have for the sport, you know, and the commitment you have to get better. And for me, it was never a sacrifice. It was never something that I was thinking, oh, this is too hard, this is too tough. You know, I had a goal, and I knew I had to, you know, work hard to achieve it. And I just tried to, you know, give the best that I had, you know, and so that I could, before a regatta would start, to have that in the back of my mind, which is very, brings you a lot of confidence when you know that you did the best you could, you know, to prepare for something. So when you, it's like studying for a exam, you know, when you know that you study for an exam, you know, you're ready and the exam can come. And I think it's the same with the preparation for a big regatta, or when you have long-term goals, you know, you have to work day by day, improve, try to learn from your mistakes, keep going back, you know, because nobody's perfect. Everybody makes mistakes, but if you're able to make even a few percentage gains each day, then overall you're going to be successful. There's a big chance you're going to be successful. And even in the laser, which is, I sailed the laser so many years, and it's a very simple boat. It's amazing how much you can learn still, you know. And I was, in this last campaign, I was really surprised some things that I said, well, I never thought about tacking this way, or I never thought about making this kind of start, or, you know, things that when you think you dominate something, there's always something that you can improve, even in the most simple of classes.
Yeah, well, it always amazes me that you've probably had so many amazing offers to go and do America's Cups, and you've dabbled with the America's Cup, but it seems like you keep on coming back to the Olympics, and your passion for the Olympics. I can't think of anybody else that has shown more passion and enthusiasm for it. And that's a whole other subject I'd like to go into, but we do have a lot of questions lining up. So let's get into these questions. And I'd like Alex, the topper sailor, to come in and ask your questions about transits, because we're getting a few questions on transit. So Alex, let's see if we can get you in.
Hi, I'm Alex. I'm a topper sailor. I currently am in British youth squads. I was wondering how often you use a transit when you start, since my coaches have always been going on about me not using them.
Yeah, good question, Alex. And yeah, I think it's something that I really rely on. And if you have that opportunity to have land behind the pin so you can get a good line side, you should do it, because it's a really good tool to have, you know, when you are, let's say, behind the line with 30 seconds to go and you're sure where the line is, you can pull the trigger with a lot of confidence. If you're not exactly sure when a line is, you're either going to be over early or you're going to be behind. So you will not have that the confidence of really, okay, I can pull the trigger here, you know. So when you start to sail with big feet, it's even more important. And usually I take a real line sight, which is, you know, exactly perfect to the line. And if I have the chance, I take another line sight, which is a little bit conservative, let's say good foot line below the line, because when you're lining up to start with, you know, a minute to go, you can check this second line side, which is, let's say, two boat lengths behind the line, and say, okay, right now I know that I am two lengths behind the line. And if the guys will not accelerate here, I can take the lead and I can pull the trigger. So it's a really good tool to have. You have to develop this and put this in your routine. You know, on every start, I try to do it, try to do it, try to do it.
And Alex, what about you? Are you keener on transits, or is it your coaches telling you that you need to get more keen about transits?
It's mostly my coaches telling me at the moment.
And why do you not want to take transits? Why are you not doing the transit thing the way that they want you to?
Because I usually just like get caught up in the amount of boats around me, because toppers are quite a big fleet in the UK. And so I can hardly see the line, let alone all the line sag.
I can give you a small tip, because when you start with the U flag or the black flag, usually when it's going to be like a minute and a half to start, everybody will get below the line. So with a minute 40 to a minute and 30 is a great time to catch that the line side, because the line will be free. So then it's really easy to, there's not going to be any boats on the line disturbing your sight. So you catch that line sight, which will be very accurate, because it's only 1 minute and a half. So there's not going to be any drifting of marks, last minute drifting or people dropping lines. And then you can peer away and go for your start. Don't wait for too long, because with 1 minute, you could be disqualified. But I usually do that when I don't want to start at an end, because if you do that a minute and a half before the start, then you're going to be late to start at the pin, let's say. But if you're going to start in the middle of the line, I think that's a bit, it's a good strategy to take the line side late.
We've got so many good questions coming in. I don't know who to give it to. I think maybe there's a real fundamental question here. Let's ask Maria Emilia Moreno Naranjo to see if she can come in and ask her question. So Maria, if you're there.
Hi, I'm Emilia. Nice to meet you all. And my question is, what are the main factors to consider in order to have a good start?
Hi, Maria. Great question. I think, well, you have to develop a certain routine before the start. So a lot of people just go to the start when it's time to take the gun, and they start without having a plan or without checking the line bias, without checking the line sight, and without doing any runs to the start to check the time and distance for the day. So usually you have to do a little bit of a research, you know. So when you go to the course, you take some time to do your tuning and check the wind, but you have to spend some time checking the line as well, and then getting the feeling of what you want to do, because what you want to do will help you make your plan on where to start. For instance, if you want to go to the left of the course, you probably need to start in the bottom third of the line. If you want to go right, you want to start more near the boat. Or if you are confident with your speed and you can start more in the middle, which is less boats. But you have to develop that routine. And one of the key things on the final acceleration, on the final, let's say, 20 seconds, is to be able to have a space to leeward. Because if you have space to leeward between you and the leeward boat, you can hang on after the start for longer and wait for the race to open up. So creating that doing exercises to develop this technique of creating a gap is very useful. So you can have this little gap below you, which is really important when it's crowded.
Maria, thank you very much. Oh, Amelia, thank you very much for that question. Robert, just on creating a gap, obviously we know that you've always been one of the fastest sailors. Would you consider yourself also to be one of the slowest sailors when you need to be?
Could be. I mean, I think you have to be able to do everything. I mean, stopping and standing still. And, you know, I was amazed. I did 1 year of 49er in 2017. And one of the things that stuck in my mind was that how much time people could stand still in light airs, you know, with a 49er, just by controlling with the body weight and the rudder and controlling the battens. People could stand still for like 4 minutes. You know, they could go to the race committee, park there and say, this is my spot, I'm going to start here. So if you develop this ability to stand still, and you don't have to have a big group to do this, you can, you know, having a mark, you can practice this. And then other things like reversing or double tacking, you know, this techniques are very useful when you need to create a gap. And another thing which is very important when you create a gap, it is that you don't create your gap too early. Because if you create a gap too early, then people will want to get in that gap. You know, people are greedy and they don't want to see you with a lot of space. You know, it's very inviting for somebody to come in. So you need to build your gap with just enough time that people cannot take this gap from you, which is like from 20, 25 seconds to 15 seconds is a great time, because that's a real gap. It's a gap that you will be able to profit.
Great. Felipe, you asked a question about 49er starting. Is there any follow-up question you want to ask, Robert? If you want to come in, please open up your video and just continue that, because it would be interesting to get a little bit more insight from Robert between slower boat starting to faster boat skiff type of starting. So Felipe, if you're here, let's get you in. Maybe we can't get him in. I'm just interested, Robert. Oh, you're here. Far away, yeah. Felipe. Thanks for joining us.
Sorry. It's okay. No, it's just, I asked the question because as the leader is a slow boat and the 49er is extremely fast boat, but you can hold still, as Robert has already said. I asked if there was the main difference for him, if he struggled a lot to make the start line on the 49er fleet, if it was the most difficult part for him, the start line on 49er in comparison with the laser start.
Hi, Felipe, the good friend of mine from Brazil. Good to see you here joining us. Yeah, well, it's very different, of course, and you know, the boat handling in the 49er when you stopped, it's not very easy to do. It's you know, you have the boat wings and you have a lot of you know, you got to be very connected with the boat and with the crew to correct the weight and not let the wings touch the water and so on. The things that make a lot of difference is the final acceleration. So in the 49er, I think the connection, when the time to pull the trigger, to put the boat to windward, connect on the trapeze and accelerate without taking too much space to leeward, because you don't want to also accelerate too low, because you're going to give all that gap. You want to try to accelerate, taking as little space as you can, but also building an off speed. And I think the Hamish is more of an expert with 49er starting, because I did only a little bit of 49er, so he can explain you better. But
it was the main difference. It was your hardest part on the 49er, the starting line, or you have other issues in comparison with the laser?
Well, I had all sorts of issues with the 49er because I started quite late. I started with 43 years old, so it was hard, the boat handling. I had a great crew, so he taught me a lot of things. And if it wasn't for him, I would be capsizing all the time. But I think what stuck me a lot was the quick decision making. You know, in the 49, you don't have too much time. You have to make the call and stick with it, and it's gonna. Your race will take a big influence from the one little mistake, you know. And in the laser, things happen a little bit slower. Even if you make a mistake, you can still, you know, come back and have a decent result. And you know, so you have to, when you're sailing these fast boats, you have to think fast and think in advance. You know, what's the next move? What's going to happen next? And where are we at? And the communication with the crew is really important. You know, it's, you have to develop this communication really precisely. So when the real battle comes, you know the right words and the right feedback you must have from the crew.
Thank you.
Felipe, thanks very much for your question. Now, Thomas, you've been asking some questions and some really good ones. You've got one about Black Flag starting. Let's see if we can get you in to ask your question to Robert. Thomas, are you there? Well, let's ask you anyway, or let's see if I can find somebody else who was asking. Oh, we got Thomas coming in. Hi, Thomas.
Yeah. We wanted to ask, when you see that other people are pushing the line, how do you adapt your starting position to that?
Yeah, well, I think risk management, Thomas, is a big thing at starts. And you have to understand your strengths and weaknesses. You have to understand the wind condition. And you have to understand the course, which side is paying. So there are times that you can be more conservative. Let's say if you are really confident that you are fast in those conditions and the race is long, you have strong winds, you feel fast. So you don't have to win a side on the start and take a big risk in the middle of a gap. You can be a bit more conservative, start more towards the middle and use your speed to crack the race open. Whereas if you have, for instance, a light air race, a sea breeze, let's say like in Tokyo, had light sea breezes and the pressure was coming always from the edges of the course. The upwind is very short, there's light wind, everybody goes the same speed. So that's the time that you need to have be a bit more aggressive at the start, because the start will dictate more or less all your race. So you have to adapt a bit your plan and your strengths to see how you're going to start. But with the black flag, usually what happens is the first black flag, usually people still push a lot. But once people start to get disqualified after the second or the third black flag, people got a bit more conservative. So that's the time that you can have a great start, when people are already, you know, okay, a lot of numbers on the board, a lot of people out of the race. People said, hey, they're getting guys, you know, let's back off a little bit. So that's the time, even when you have a good line sight, you can really shoot before the guys and have a great start. So you should also understand the dynamics of what's happening with the starting sequences and people getting over the line and so on.
Thomas, have you got any follow-up questions?
When do you choose to start more on the sides and when do you prefer to start a bit more to the middle?
Well, I'm considered a bit of a conservative starter, and that's been a little bit my mistake in the last two games, where I kind of used the strategy that worked for me for so many years, and I won so many regattas by starting in the middle of the course. But in the past, I had a little bit of speed edge on the boats next to me, so I could afford to start to be more conservative, start in the middle, with a good line sight, a good gap to leeward. And from then on, I could open the race up, you know, using my speed. But once you don't have that speed edge anymore, you have to try to start better, you know, more towards the edges. And like I told you, I think depends a lot on the conditions. If you start on a shifty place, puffy and shifty, if you start in the middle and you can play the shifts, you know, take the 10, 15 degree knocks, you're going to be doing well. Whereas if you start in a light sea breeze where the pressures come from the edges, you're going to have to start more towards one edge and the other. But overall, I think the best starters, they are consistent. That's the key word. Because having one great start and the next start being a really bad one, it doesn't cut it. So the key is to try to get off the line at the top, let's say top 15, top 20% of the fleet. So then you have options still to work your game plan, go to where you want to go and round the top mark in good shape. And from then on, you can have good results. But if you risk too much, you know, you're going to have some black flags or you're going to have some disaster starts as well. So it's a fine balance. You have to push the envelope a little bit in training. So in training, I like to risk more and try to win the pin, try to win the boat, because it forces you to be uncomfortable. Because if you always do the comfortable thing, always start in the middle with a place, a space to leeward, when the time comes for you to win the pin, you don't know how to. So you have to kind of push the envelope in the training and then perhaps back off a little bit when the real race starts.
Robert, thanks for that. Thomas, thanks for your questions. Thomas, just tell us where are you in the world and who are you hanging out with today?
We're the Dutch standard team. We're training in Villamora.
So how's it going for you?
Today was a tough day, but it's been great.
Awesome. Well, that's been Olympic Sailing Central for the last couple of years, so you're in the right place. Best of luck with your training. Thanks for your questions, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the call. Now, Robert, talking about not having as much speed and that speed advantage that you used to have, I wonder if you can just turn your mind towards any handicap racing that you've done, maybe in keelboats, because one of our early questions, I'd like to get back to that from Rod, who asks about PHRF racing. I don't know if you've done PHRF, but if you've done ORC or IRC, tell us about the challenges of starting on a line when you're not the fastest boat.
Yeah, well, it's a great question. I've done some, not a lot, but I think you have to also, adapt your game plan to what you have in hand, you know. And that also counts a lot when you're sailing, you know, with perhaps an owner driver that doesn't have so much confidence to win the pin or to win the boat. You have to, as a tactician or as a strategist, create a plan that the person is able to execute and not make something too difficult, which you will end up in a worse result. So usually, if you have big boats faster than you, starting to leeward of these big boats, it's going to be tough because they're going to roll you and you're going to have to tack away. So one of the options you have when you are slower is to try to win the race committee side, or at least be on the windward side of these big boats and be able at least to tack off and be free for a few minutes, because those guys are going to be gone very quickly, and then you're going to have free air again. But the beginning of the race, if you get rolled straight away, then you're in big trouble.
Great. We have also got quite a few questions coming in about training alone. Rose Lee, I'm going to see if I can get you in to ask your question to Robert.
Hi, everyone. So I basically train alone with my brother. We don't have much sailing on here in PNG, Papua New Guinea. We sail alone a lot and we don't have much opportunity to go out and race with others. So see how well we're doing from time to time. What are some drills that you would use while training alone, especially to practice your stats?
Hi, Rosie. Yeah, great question. Thanks a lot. I also did a lot of sailing on my own in my early days in Brazil. I went out many times without a coach, without a training partner, and trying to create like situations and trying to make a goal for my day. I think for starting, at least if you can bring a few marks out, or if you have some marks already set, you know, it could be a boat that is anchored or a short mooring mark, you know, that you could practice, you know, standing still. This is one of the first thing is to try to stand still, you know, stop and then accelerate, stop and accelerate. And one of the most important things is to develop this time and distance to the line. So you can exercise this by giving a time, and then you can start, you know, and developing this feel of how much time do I take from going from this point to that point. You know, that's one of these exercises you can do. And then once you are comfortable with this, you can learn how to double tack before the start, which is also a nice thing to do if you are in a, let's say, in a race and you're in a tight spot, but you still have 20 to 30 seconds, you can still double tack. Okay. And you have to learn how, if you're on a laser, reversing, going backwards is like a handy thing to learn also. But like this slowing down and accelerating, and you know, it's very important. I think being able to use your rudder, you know, and understanding the rules as well, because the rules are tricky with the yellow flags. So when you are head to win, you can scope to come down to close hold scores. So that's legal. But if you keep crossing the center of the boat with your rudder, then you're probably going to get a yellow flag. So I think these exercises could help you a lot. But at one stage, you have to try to find a race, because yeah, it's quite different when you have more boats around you, you know, trying to start in the same place as you are, or, you know, disturbing you or coming to leeward of you. So it would be a great opportunity if you, okay, practice like this, but once find a race, if you can, to try to execute this with other boats around you. Yeah.
Rosalie, do you have any follow-up questions? Anything else you'd like to ask Robert?
I don't have much. Thank you for answering my question. It was really good to meet you guys. Thank you again.
Thank Great. You. All the best.
Thank you.
Thanks for having you on the call, Rosalie. Hamish, this is a common challenge. How do you replicate a regatta situation when you've only got a few boats to do it with? And the problem that most people think about is the start and maybe busy lured mark rounding. So just give us your insights into what you were doing with the 49er squad, for example, when there was so little racing over the last couple of years.
Yeah, well, you know, for sure, you can do a lot by yourself with boat handling. And it's one of those give me's, you know, there's no excuse to not having perfect boat handling. The 49 is a good one for that, because it becomes a boat handling race pretty quickly when the wind speeds reach or the wave conditions reach, you know, quite a low number. You're already in a boat handling race, and you can do all that on your own. You know, you can just find a mark, like Robert said. You can get super good at tacking and jiving around that mark. If you've got two marks and you do the figure of eights, both with tacking and jiving, until, you know, you just get it perfect. And that boat handling side of things will open doors massively for your performance in a race. So yeah, no excuses there. For people sailing isolated, you can arrive at the regatta with better boat handling than anyone in the fleet, in terms of turning corners and tacking and jiving. So that's an opportunity. But it's interesting, Robert, I'd like to see, I mean, looking at the chat box, and you probably have too, but one that comes up a lot is, and I probably shouldn't do this, Andy, but I'm really keen to ask that question myself, but it's just your routine, you know, leading to the start. You know, you've got something, obviously, I always notice you left early, always one of the early competitors on the water. Can you just give us a timeline down to the start?
Yeah, Hamish, I usually like to, I don't have to be one of the first, but I like to be, to go to the water, you know, let's say one hour before the race. I can spend some time checking the course, check my settings, you know, especially if I'm in a boat like the Star, it's quite important to dial in the conditions and make some small adjustments to your rig if you need, and get a feel for the shifts, for the waves. In the laser, I think it's quite important before the start to sail a little bit downwind to get a feel for the waves and what is working and which jibe is more comfortable to sail on that day and what kind of technique is working better on that day. And from then on, I would like to go to the start and let's say 10 minutes before the orange flag. And I start to check the line if the line is already set. If the line is not set, I like to do a few runs to the race committee, time runs. So I just give a minute and I do a few runs so I can check the time and distance for that day. And that could be current, it could be drifting to the side. So you know already that at the start, you could be a few lengths above the race committee that the current is going to throw you down. And how much time I need that day to get to full speed. So once I do that and the line is set, I like to sail along the line, you know, take the line side if I can, but I like to sail through the line. So I can have a feel for the wind in each point of the line. And then I check the bias with my compass. That's something that I can do by running down the line. I can, right in the middle of the line, I can come head to wind, and then I can see with my compass if the line is perfect or if it's skewed to the pin or to the boat. And I think it's important if it's a very shifty day to be open-minded, because sometimes you make a plan too early and things change, and things could change in the last 2 minutes, you know. So I like to always at like kind of 3 minutes before the start, to 3 or 2 minutes, to stand up on my boat and have my last view of the course and try to confirm the call. So I'm thinking, okay, it's the top third of the line, but let's see the course. If I see something good on the left, I might change that plan. So I leave the call as late as possible. But also you cannot be, you know, overthinking too many times. I give myself maybe one chance to change the call. And then from then on is about positioning myself and then perhaps, like I said before, confirming my line sight. If it's very crowded and I wasn't able to get the line sight at 4 minutes, let's say, I would go again in the race committee at a minute 40. Get the line side when a line is free, and then I will go to my spot. But always, I think one very important thing about the final approach is that the race only starts at zero. So even if you have little time left, 35 seconds, 30 seconds, and if you feel that you are not in a good spot, you still have the time to tack away or bear away and find another gap. And a lot of the times you can find a much better gap than you had before. And I've seen a lot of people making this mistake of being stuck in the middle of a lot of boats, knowing that they already will not have a good start, but not changing their plan and not trying to do anything, just waiting for the time to go and then confirming that they will have a bad start. So you got to be, you know, quite proactive at this time and say, hey, this is not a good gap. Let's reverse. Let's do a double tack. Let's try something, because it's the moment that the cards are dealt. Usually the start is the moment. If you start well, you have options. If you don't start well, you're going to left with the option that nobody wants to. And it's still not race over. There's still opportunities, but it's a lot easier when once you put your bow out and you create options for your race.
Great question, Hamish. I hope that addresses a lot of the issues. There's loads I'd like to follow up on there, but we are running out of time. But talking about the race not being over, Robert, we've got a question from Erin about Plan B. Erin, if you're able to come in, you've asked a couple of really nice questions, so take your pick. But I'm particularly interested in Plan B. Are you there, Erin? Hi, Erin.
Hi. I was just kind of wondering how important it is, you think, to have a plan B on the start line. Like, would you focus more on your plan A and that would just be a very much a backup plan, or would you be preparing a plan B a lot more as well?
Hi, Erin. Yeah, really great question. And I think you always have to have an idea of what to do when things don't go well, which happens very often. Like, I mean, at the high level, there's so many good guys there trying to have a good start. And it's quite often that you don't execute your start really well. But like I said, it's not race over because the boats are still pretty close, you know. And you might be able to tack away, get free, tack back, and still have a decent lane and have chances in the race. Or you could live on a thin hip, wait for a shift, and then start to getting phase. So there are still opportunities. The first important thing is not to panic right after a bad start, because a lot of people just, okay, I had a bad start, so I'm going to go behind a lot of boats and bang a corner and hope that's the right one. So they're going to deviate from their plan because they had a bad start. So that's the wrong thing, because usually when you do this second bad call, that's the one that's going to really hurt you. So one bad call, you can still get away with it, but the second one is pretty tough. So I like to also, when I sail on a bigger boat, to talk to the crew before the start, what my plan A is and what my plan B is. So to have everybody on the same page. Say, okay, guys, we're going to try to win the pin here. But if we see that it's going to be too tight or we can't do it, we're going to go behind and start on the top of this line or something like this. So to have everybody on the same page, it's important, because the trimmers, they also know what they will expect. And I've seen a lot of guys having bad start, but really, really quickly getting back into the race like that. They find a good lane, they tech in a good place, they can survive, they have good pointing ability, and they're right back into the race. So race not over. You have to look out of the boat, be patient, and see and figure out for yourself what's the best option you have after a bad start.
Erin, thank you very much for your question. We've got a real tricky one, which actually goes to the heart of some of the things that Hamish talks about on Road to Gold. This is a question from Noah Sangulin. And Noah, you've asked a few really nice questions. So if we can get you in, I would like you to ask your latest question, which is a real good one. Noah Sangulin. Let's see if we can get you in. Can't talk right now. Okay, so I'm going to ask it for you. So Robert, how to equate the position at the start with the strategic plan if the plans don't match? So, for example, the race committee boat is favoured, but the left side of the field is better. How do you balance those priorities?
Yeah, really good question. I think it depends a lot on the length of the line. So if it's a big line and if it's 10 degrees favoured, that means a lot of meters. If it's a short line and you know, 10 degrees might not be too much. So I like to think, you know, in a meadow race, for example, if the pin is favored by 10 degrees, but the line is quite short, so winning the pin will not give you a big advantage. So if you like the ride on that situation, I'd still would like to start on top of the boats and picking my time to tack. Whereas, you know, if the windward side is favored by 10 degrees, but I want to go left. I could still start below the boats and I won't be too far behind because the line is short. But if you start, like we had the Star European Championship in 2010 in Via Reggio in Italy with 140 boats. And the line was a 3-point line. And it took maybe 10 minutes to sail from one side to the other of the line. So in a line like this, if you have 5 or 10 degrees favored in one side, you gotta be on that side because it's too many meters, you know.
Hamish, you're really strong on this stuff in Road to Gold. Winning the start doesn't necessarily win you the race. And a lot of us may be guilty of thinking we've had a great start and that's going to put us in a great position, but maybe not. So just tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I think Robert alluded to this as well. You know, but if you got a pin in bias line, it's typically because the breeze is left of the average, and you really to win that race, you really need to be on port. You need to be tacking. You see a lot of people enjoying, you know, a pin in start win, and they sail off to the horizon on the biggest header of the day, and that's not going to help. So it's really a matter of making sure you bring back the plan. And engage what your start gives you, the plan you want, the strategy you want. So you if it's in lifted tack and you know it's an oscillating breeze, well, you've got to make sure that the start gives you that opportunity to tack. So I think one of the things we haven't discussed, Robert, is really interesting is, you know, a lot of people, obviously people rely enormously on the start, the timing. How do you get really good confidence in knowing you've got the race committee's time? Do you have any techniques there? In terms of, do you watch the flag to push the button on your watch, or do you watch the hooter and do you double check that you have the race committee's time?
Yeah, I like to get as close as possible to the race committee, because if you are far, then you're going to be 1 or 2 seconds late. By the time you hear the sound or you check the flag, and the flag could be a little bit late. So when you're close to the race committee, you can hear the countdown from the race officer. So the countdown is going to be really, really precise. And I think you can really, that's a very good point, Hamish, because you can really be, you know, overrate this and, you know, be sometimes doing something else, checking the wind or checking your boat and just getting the time from far away. And if you're 2 seconds off, that could be the difference between a good and a bad start. So that will be another good one to add on the starting procedure.
Thanks, Robert.
We are nearly on time. We started late, so we're finishing late. We've got so many good questions that don't even relate to starting, and I would love to be asking you those as well, Robert, but we've had so much energy and so many interesting questions about our specialist subject that I'm going to let you off the hook and maybe not ask you some of the interesting questions in some of the other areas. But you've got kids, and I'm sure that you would love them to get into sailing as well. But while I ask you that, let's see if we can get Dayumling. I don't know how to pronounce that exactly, but you've got a question about playful training games that you can get the young guns into the club, into fun training sessions. So Dayumling, let's see if we can get you in. Robert, what ambitions do you have for your kids?
Yeah, well, I think I would like them to do sports, because I think sports are really healthy. The person is going to be a more healthy if they do any kind of sports. And that's the way I was brought up by my dad. Really healthy life, doing things outdoors. It's a totally different thing to try to become a champion, you know, and I think that's up to them. My older son is sailing Optimist now. Quite well. Last year, he finished 17 at the Optimist World Championship here in Lake Garda. So I was quite surprised, because, you know, Optimist classes has a lot of depth. And well, we'll see. We'll see how things go forward. It's not an easy thing to have the father and the mother being Olympic medalists. And I hope we can use our knowledge to support him, but not put too much weight on him. It's important that he enjoys the journey and enjoys this his sailing. And we're trying to make him do other sports as well, because I think that's also very healthy, you know, especially at a younger age. I think you should not specify too much your activity. You should do other things. And maybe later in life, when you're 17, 18, 20, you can be more specific about what you want to achieve. But overall, I just want them to be outdoor and doing sports.
Great. Well, that's another topic we could go so much further into. But Dayomling, if you are unmuted and able to ask your question, we'll go a little bit further into it, maybe, because it's a really nice question. Let's see if we can get you to put it to Robert.
Yeah, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Great. Unfortunately, my webcam isn't working, so you have to live with my voice only. thank you for the opportunity to ask my question. And in general, for this amazing talk, my question is, I had a lot of, or I read a lot of books, and all the trainings and drills that were mentioned there were always very focused on the task itself, to getting starched right. And I was wondering if Robert has any experience or tips or suggestions about more playful training games that encourage or that that contain a lot of fun. Because in my experience, start training is often something that is less fun for the young people when they start sailing, and mixing it with a little bit more playful stuff would I think increase the motivation to do more training of the start itself.
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. I think the goal for all these coaches, of especially the optimist, and when they start, is to keep it fun. And I think the kid, when he goes to the yacht club, he has to enjoy that the atmosphere and the company of the other boys. And I think there should be the time to work on some specifics. You shouldn't also be extremely loose. But also there should be the time to enjoy yourself and to do, yeah. I mean, you could let them play a ball after the end of the training, or play some games on the land, or even change boats when you are, or sometimes get all the kids together to go out on a cruising boat and enjoy themselves, or make a race between two cruising boats with two crews of just kids. And I think these are the ways to make them, you know, have more fun with each other and enjoy more the sport. But of course, some guys like to compete more than the others, and it's not easy in a group. There you're going to have many personalities, so you have to keep a balance between making the things fun and enjoyable, but also for the guys who are competitive, to help them progress and to give them the exercises that are necessary. So I think try to find a nice balance between seriousness and just fun.
Dermling, thanks very much for your question. And Robert, really nice to hear that. It chimes very much with Hamish's approach to youth sailing as well. So we're pretty much on time now, but I'm just going to ask on John Bennett's behalf, what plans for Paris do you have?
Well, Andy, before the end of the call, I have to tell you that I really appreciate you asking me my final career question on the media zone in Tokyo. You were the only journalist who asked me a question in the media zone. So all the medalists were giving interviews, and I was walking through that zone. I was a little disappointed, you know, it was my last show at the games, but you were the one who came and asked me a question. So I don't even remember what the question was, but I really appreciate it, Andy. So yeah, for Paris, I mean, I had a great run. I mean, 7 Olympic Games. I achieved a lot more than what I thought I could. You know, these last 2 games were already, you know, a lot. I lost a lot of out of my body to do the games at 43 and then at 48. And I think I achieved pretty decent results considering, you know, my advanced age. And I enjoyed myself a lot. I think these last 2 games, I enjoyed a lot because Rio was my home country and it was a lot of energy. And then in Tokyo, you know, it was tough, but I was really happy that I was still able to be competitive out there. I missed the medal, but not so much. You know, I kind of struggled on the lighter days. But I fulfilled my goal, which is going there with a chance and fighting for it with the young guys. So I'm pretty happy where I'm at. I don't want to ask a lot too much, especially in a laser. It's a shame that the star is not Olympic anymore. Otherwise, I could have tried again in the star, which would be great. But yeah, we're sailing some big boats, a little bit of coaching, and yeah, just enjoying family with time with the family, because in the last few years I've been very busy traveling a lot. So the kids are at that age, I think, that they need a father around them, and try to profit this time.
Well, just like Hamish, you've managed to tread an incredible line of having an amazing professional career in your own right, and also be a great father and a great husband as well. So it's an enormous credit to you that you managed to excel in so many different areas of your life. Now, 12 hours from now, we are going to be doing a session with Ben Ainslie. I just wonder what question, Robert, we should pass on to you. Pass on to Ben from you. Anything you want us to ask Ben tomorrow on the session?
From me?
Yeah.
Well, just say hi from me to him. And actually, I think I'm going to ask him something. I remember in Athens, he had a tough protest with a French guy and he was disqualified. And we thought that it was going to be quite hard for him to recover from that and win the gold. But he did it. So it's quite impressive to be able to do this in such a high pressure environment. So I think his mindset and how to wash off all that junk, you know, and the protest situation. And even when you come off the protest, there's a lot of thoughts in your mind and how to clean it up out of your mind and go fresh the next day and still win the gold medal. It's pretty impressive.
Well, that happens to be exactly the topic that we're going to be asking Ben about tomorrow. It's about mental strength, mental toughness. So you've absolutely hit the nail on the head there, Robert. Right, we will finally let you go. Hamish, any concluding comments from you from talking to this amazing sailor?
Exactly that. Talking to this amazing sailor has just been such a privilege to have you on, Rob. And you go well in the future. Thanks for your time. And you look forward to catching up soon.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate. Keep going with the great work you guys are doing. All the best.
Oh, well, with help from people like you, it means so much. Thank you so much, Robert. Thanks to all the questions we've had. We've had so much energy on this call. Thank you to Stephen Reichenfeld for sharing a starting routine within the chat box. I hope some of you have cut and paste that. Some really great information going through this session. But from Hamish and me, from Robert, that's it for now. We will be back in 12 hours' time for another session with Sir Ben Ainslie, where we'll be talking about mental strength, and we will make sure that we will ask Robert's question on that call. But for the time being, that's it from Road to Gold. We will see you very soon. Bye for now.